Hey, how am I supposed to see what you... Holy God, what do you want?
I'm taking your train.
Calling the city cops. The train's been hijacked.
Command center calling Pelham 123. Come in, please.
Your locomotive has been hijacked by a group of heavily armed men.
New York City subway system is the largest in the world.
Hold it right there, cowboy!
Warren, goddammit, this city hasn't got $1 million.
Identify yourself, please.
I'm the man who stole your train.
Well, sir, there is no way you can get away with this. You are underground in a tunnel.
Welcome to the third episode of The Projection Booth. I'm Mike White, and with me, as always, is Mondo Justin.
Hello.
So this week, we'll be playing an interview Justin and I did a few weeks back with Chris Gore. For those of you who aren't in the know, Chris is an author, comedian, and screenwriter, as well as the founder of Film Threat magazine. He's also one of the co-hosts of the G4 Network's Attack of the Show. But before we get into that, we'll be covering the 1974 film, The Taking of Pelham 123. Now, Justin, you had this week's pick. Why did you decide on Pelham for your choice?
Well, why not? You know, I mean, I've loved this movie since the first time I ever saw it. It's very much a product of the 70s. You know, it's got this amazing cast: Walter Matthau, Jerry Stiller, Robert Shaw, Doris Roberts, Martin Balsam. You know, it's got this amazing tension to it. And plus, you know, it just feels like super big to me in every sense of the word. You know, super exciting type of film that forces you on the edge of your seat. You know, plus it's, you know, where Tarantino ripped off, borrowed his character's names for his film Reservoir Dogs, right?
Yeah, but that's never happened before, Tarantino taking something from somebody else, right?
You know, I guess before we get into it, we should probably tell any of the six people on planet Earth that, you know, haven't seen the film, you know, or any of its horrible remakes, you know, what the film is all about. And since you've got the better radio voice, Mike, why don't you, you know, offer up your synopsis?
Well, I don't know about the radio voice, but I'll try it out anyway. The Taking of Pelham 123 is about four guys who take over a subway train. They use code names, as you said, Mr. Blue, Mr. Brown, Mr. Gray, Mr. Green, and they hold it for ransom for, I can't remember what the original amount of money is that they hold it for, but they contact the guy who's running the trains, and that's Walter Matthau, and they have there's a really nice rapport going back and forth between Robert Shaw and Walter Matthau, and it's, you know, the heist goes fairly well until towards the end, and then we get to see some good detective work from Mr. Matthau. So it is.
And you could say, you know, that the characters, you know, that is the hijackers, essentially their egos and greed get in the way of essentially pulling off a perfect heist.
Exactly. So let's play a little bit of audio from the trailer really quick, and then Justin and I will be back in a few to discuss the film.
1:23 p.m. A crowded subway train starts its run from Pelham Station in the Bronx. 1:45 p.m. Four desperate, heavily armed men seize control of the train.
Open the door or I'll blow your head off.
Taking 17 people as hostages.
Your attention, please. Now then, you'll all remain seated. Anybody who tries to rise is going to get shot.
I do hope I have made myself understood.
2:13 p.m. The city of New York is given 1 hour to come up with $1 million ransom.
You're out of your skull.
No all units stand by on a double.
What's up, Z?
A train's been hijacked.
Millions have read it. Now you can live it. The Taking of Pelham 123.
There is no way you can get away with this. You are underground in a tunnel.
At precisely 3:13, we are going to begin executing the hostages. Let's go!
Nothing will happen as long as you obey my orders.
New York City is held powerless in the grip of four ruthless men. From the mayor's office.
Don't tell me, I don't want to know.
To police headquarters.
I've got about 50 men inside the tunnel, all wearing vests and armed with machine and submachine guns. We could fight the Third World War down there.
To the nerve center of the world's busiest subway system.
My only priority is saving the lives of these passengers.
Maybe an hour isn't enough time.
An hour is plenty of time.
We agree to pay the ransom. Repeat, we agreed to pay the money. Now turn your clock off. The money has to be counted, stacked, tied, transported uptown. It just isn't physically possible.
You'd be surprised what's physically possible.
Pelham 123's in motion.
How long does it take to get all that money together anyway?
Just not gonna make it.
passengers at Dead Ducks.
What the hell do they expect for that lousy 35 cents to live forever?
Walter Matthau, Robert Shaw. The most spectacular hijack in history. The taking of Pelham 123.
Wow, you know, I really love that guy's voice narrating trailer. So we're back and, you know, getting right into it. Mike, I was curious to see, you know, what the hell did you think of this movie? You know, what do you think makes it so great?
Well, first off, the score. I mean, the way that the movie begins, that score is awesome. And just those, you know, that horn section and just that kind of pounding rhythm and the percussion and everything are just fantastic. But, you know, the story, I think, is really what's, you know, what sets it apart first off. And then the acting is terrific as well. I mean, it's the whole package. It's kind of sucks for me to just be like, well, the lighting is really good as well. But everything about this movie, I really, really enjoy. But I especially, I mean, this was made, you know, Walter Matthau was just knocking him out of the park at this time. You know, he was doing a string of films like The Laughing Policeman and Charlie Varick and this film. And all, those three films stand to me in some sort of like pantheon of just fantastic cinema. And it doesn't hurt either that all three of those are crime films. And that's a genre I really enjoy. But I think the acting is where it's at. And just the relationship of Matthau with Jerry Stiller, and then him trying to get information out of Robert Shaw via the radio. And it's kind of that Wrath of Khan thing, too, where you never really see the two main characters in the same place at the same time, which I know, you know, towards the end, they actually do get to see each other. But the whole movie is those two guys speaking to each other over the radio.
Right. You know, and, you know, with Walter Matthau, what I find extremely interesting is how he had this run, but he also was able to switch up and do like these amazing comedies at the time. He did like The Odd Couple, and, you know, just he has that bizarre, it's like he always switched up between the two. And I think that's what makes him really interesting as well. And you know, Robert Shaw is, of course, great. It's a whole, I think, creme de la creme of New York actors in a sense, too. And, you know, one of the people we actually forgot to mention earlier, who actually we tried to get an interview with for the show, is Hector Elizondo. And we couldn't make it happen. But, you know, he's great in it, too, because he's essentially the catalyst to bringing the guys down, you know, in a sense. So, you know, kudos to the whole cast. It's just amazing. And you know, on that note, you know, do you have a favorite scene? Because for me, one of my favorite scenes is, you know, where Matthau's giving the Japanese guys a tour. And, you know, he thinks that, you know, he thinks that they don't speak English, but in fact they do. And he's basically, you know, ripping on them. So, Mike, do you have a favorite scene?
I love the end. The end is one of the best things ever for me. But I think that, what I love about it more than one particular scene is just the rapport between the people and just that kind of New York cynicalism that comes through. So, okay, no, I have a favorite line, and that's when, speaking of characters that are only talking via the radio, when Walter Matthau finally meets one of the policemen and he finds that he's this big, tall, black guy, and he, you know, he's taken aback by that. He thinks one of the other guys is this character who he'd only been talking to before, and he's just like, oh, I thought you'd be taller or something. He's just completely trying to cover his tracks. But yeah, it was really, that's my favorite little bit in there.
Mr. Daniels.
Daniels.
Oh, I thought you were a shorter guy. Well, I don't know what I thought. Anything happening, Inspector?
No, they're still down there. The street collapsed. We'd probably land right
on top
of them.
Command sent it to DCI Manhattan. Command sent it to DCI Manhattan.
Oh, yeah.
There we go. This is Garber.
Track's been cleared for a couple of minutes now.
Do you want me to call the hijackers?
Yeah, let them know. And let us know when they start moving, will you?
What do we do? Way to get started. If they pick up speed on us, we're going to have trouble keeping up with them.
I think we ought to take off, Inspector. Get a jump on them for a change.
Move it. Tell the sergeant to hold them in here until further word.
Yes, sir.
Fits like a glove.
Is it going to come away clean?
It's going to work all right.
Command sent it to Pelham 123. Command sent it to Pelham 123. Come in, Pelham.
Who's that? Give me the mic. Yeah.
This is Pelham. What I'm the garden.
Even great men have to pee. Just letting you know the track's cleared all the way to South Ferry.
Thank you. Give the lieutenant my regards.
You can do it yourself at the arraignment.
Yeah, I totally love that part, too. It's amazing. You know, going back a little bit, I know that you actually read the book, you know, prior to recording the show, and I didn't actually this time. You know, I did that back for the Stuntman when we did that in episode one. But so I was wondering if you could, you know, just talk a little bit about the book and let everyone listening how, you know, or if there's any differences in comparison to the film with the book.
Well, the book, I hate to say this because it just sounds so, you know, Philistine, but it's just the book almost had too many characters, and they were not all of them were that interesting. I mean, I love the Martin Balsam character, and the Robert Shaw character, the Walter Matthau character, and the Jerry Stiller character are my favorites. And then I do like Hector Elizondo as Joe Welcome is great, and I love how they kind of throw that in as a little, you know, it threw it, in the beginning of the book. They talk about how his name is was Giuseppe Bienvenuto, so it translated into Joe Welcome, and they have that as a joke towards the end of the movie version of it. But the book is told in a series of, it's told from each character's perspective, and it kind of builds along those lines where you know first you're in the eyes of this robber and then that robber, and then you're someone on the train, and you get to read all these different things. And I have to say, after a while, it was just like, okay, enough. I don't need all of this. It was almost too much stuff to it. And there were a lot of characters I just didn't care about that much. So I think that the filmmakers did a very good job of paring it down into just the basic story and then letting the actors kind of fill out those characters a little bit more to make them more human.
Yeah. It's, you know, you mentioned the filmmakers, and that's one of my favorite aspects of the film. It was directed by Joseph Sargent. And, you know, you mentioned Hector Alexander's character in the book as having a different name. And actually Joseph Sargent was born with the name Giuseppe Sargente. And, you know, he had an interesting progression in the sense that he started out, you know, basically directing television. And he even did my favorite episode of Star Trek, which is the Carbonite Maneuver. And then he got stuck making these crazy TV movies. Eventually, he ended up making White Lightning before taking Apollo 123. So, you know, in terms of direction, I think Apollo 123 is probably my favorite piece of New York cinema. I know that, I guess, for early 70s, in the sense that, you know, the film feels just potently big, and there's all those wonderful shots like of cranes, you know, the camera's on a crane going over the city, and it just feels like such a huge scope involved. You know, you see all these extras and it's really exciting, and you don't see that in, like, you know, some of the other New York films of the early 70s. It's just got this huge feeling to it that you're actually there and you're witnessing this thing, and it's just super exciting.
Well, it's ironic that it does feel like a big movie, even though so much of it takes place within the confines of a subway train. You know, this easily, in the hands of somebody else, this could have felt like a stage play. You know, it could have been like, oh, stage one is where you're on the train, and then, you know, act two, we cut to the railroad station where it's all the reactions to what's happening on the train. You know, you could divide the stage right down in half and have one set being, you know, the robbers and one set being the train people. So, but it's not that way. It does feel like you're getting a whole lot of the city, and there's not a whole lot of exterior shots, but every single one of them matters. And I, another favorite actor of mine, Kenneth McMillan, plays a police, I think he's a sergeant or whatever. I'm not sure of his rank, but he's, you know, holding back the crowds that are gathered around some of the subway entrances. And that scene to me, you know, it's small as far as duration. It's quick, but it does really capture what you're talking about. You do feel very man on the street and kind of capture that. And I like the whole, going back to the cynical nature of things, the whole way that, you know, politics are really playing a role in this, with the mayor and having to get the mayor out of bed because he's sick, and the deputy mayor just telling him, you know, I'm not handling this for you. You need to come down and handle this. And then when the mayor shows up and the whole crowd starts booing him, that was terrific.
Yeah, that's Tony Roberts too. You know, everyone knows him from the Woody Allen movies. You know, quick question for you. We should have talked about this a few minutes ago, but, you know, since you read the book, was the ending in the book the same as it was in the movie?
Actually, no, it wasn't. The whole idea, and I don't know how much we want to get into spoilers. I feel like, you know, this is a movie that everyone should have seen already. And, well, I guess I really do need to talk about the ending, because the ending does change in, actually slightly in the first remake and definitely in the second remake. But in the book, the Martin Balsam character does not have a cold. So that whole setup of the ending doesn't happen at all in the book. And so it is just kind of a, you know, strange way. It ends where you know that he's going to be caught, but it's not like, you know, it's not the great ending that the film has.
And the ending is also very traditionally 70s. You know, you don't see movies ending and that. I mean, it's kind of it's an unpredictable ending and it fits perfectly, but you don't see that type of ending moving forward throughout movie history. Essentially, it's so bizarre, but it's just like, hell yeah, you know, like it just ends perfectly. But you don't see that in movies going on forward after that, really.
Yeah, they really tried to redo that ending for the first remake of it, the one with
D'Onofrio, Vincent D'Onofrio.
Right, Vincent D'Onofrio. I'm trying to remember who played the Walter Matthau character.
Isn't it James Edward Olmos or something like
yes,
that?
Yes, thank you. I kept wanting to say Adama from Battlestar Galactica.
That would be awesome.
Now, if Adama was there, he could have caught these guys much easier. But they use Lorraine Bracco is in the film, and she's playing the Jerry Stiller role. And I don't know if it's just this kind of like, you know, oh, well, we really need to bolster the woman's role, because there are very few women in the original Taking Pelham 1-2-3 at all. And so with this remake, they put Lorraine Bracco into the Jerry Stiller role, and they have her and Edward James Olmos acting as like a detective team. And at the very end, the end is the same, you know, the door opening, but instead of it, Walter Matthau coming in and doing the I got you kind of thing in his eyes. I love that look on his face. It's both Lorraine Bracco and Edward James Olmos. And it's almost like, oh, really? You had to go there? It strikes such a false tone for me that it just kind of ruins everything that went before it.
Yeah, you know, it's just such a weird ending. Like, but it's brilliant on the same level. It's just, yeah, it's just really bizarre. You know, one of the universal questions I think here at hand is, you know, what it comes down to is, I know with a movie you have to suspend disbelief to a certain extent. So, you know, I guess I want to talk about whether this heist is actually believable. I mean, you know, do you think it could really be done? I mean, maybe then, but, you know, certainly not now with security cameras and stuff. So what's your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that kind of leads right into a good discussion of the Tony Scott remake of the film, you know, because it is them trying to do this same thing now, or, you know, 2 years ago, whenever this movie came out. And again, everything in that remake just really rings false, and it doesn't even feel like that movie is set in reality, because I don't know. I mean, I've been on subway systems around the world, you know, Barcelona, London, Toronto, Chicago, all these things. And I noticed the people in Barcelona had cell reception on their subway, but no place else have I ever gotten cell reception. So so much of this remake hinges on cell phones and on internet connection. And it's like, this is the one time where a movie can get away with that whole, none of our cell phones work. You know, like that's like the whole thing with so many films these days is trying to get, you know, trying to kill the protagonist or the antagonist's cell phone. You know, it's like, well, geez, yeah, if this girl was out in the woods, you know, she could just pick up her cell phone and call somebody. And then they have to have the obligatory, no, our cells don't work out here. Well, so yeah, so the remake of Taking a Pelham 123, they're down in a freaking subway tunnel. They should not have any kind of access to anything, as far as I'm concerned. But then there's this whole thing about how this guy is, like, you know, on a cam with his girlfriend, and then you've got John Travolta, and he's like Googling the Denzel Washington character, and it was just like, it was so silly, you know. And so it's, I know this really isn't answering your question, but it was funny to me that maybe this kind of heist could happen today. And then, you know, but yeah, maybe not because of the security cameras and all that. And I'm sure that there are systems inside of the subway tunnels that are much better as far as communicating from one place to another and all this kind of stuff. But as far as the robbers and stuff went, it rang so false with the remake.
Yep. And I will just say one thing about the Travolta remake. Fuck you, Tony Scott.
It was so over-directed. My God. Just I've heard Stuart Anderson from Cinephobia Radio talk about the, I think he calls it like a stutter shot or something. Just that kind of, like, you know, pulsing in onto stuff. And he's doing that all over the place in this movie. It was driving me crazy. All these shots of the outside, you know, everything that you were talking about with the establishing shots of New York, that all worked in the Joseph Sargent one. In the Tony Scott version, it felt like he was bored. You know, that's the thing with Tony Scott and sometimes his brother. It feels like they're bored making these movies, so they have to make them more interesting for themselves visually, and they just overdo it. It's like, this should be a simple story of, you know, characters, but they have to rely on these camera tricks way too much.
Hey, Ryder.
Money here yet?
On the way.
And what the fuck you calling me for?
Actually, I just called to talk.
Oh, yeah? What do you want to talk about?
You said that being in the motorman's cab, that was a little like being in a confessional, right?
Yeah.
I was thinking maybe it's a little like being in a prison cell, too.
What are you trying to say? That if I get caught, I better get used to it?
No, I'm just wondering. I mean, maybe you're already used to it. I'm wondering maybe that's how you meet a guy like Phil Ramos?
How the fuck do you know that? But why don't you tell me, Garber? Then we'll both know. I mean, after today's confession, you're going to find your ass in prison, too.
You know, what's one thing interesting about Joseph Sargent's direction, if you think about it, and maybe I'm reaching a little bit, but the way it's done is like, it's almost like there's a claustrophobia to it, okay? And so when you get outside, that big feeling is like, it's almost like a breath of fresh air.
Yeah, completely. And it's almost like, what's going to happen when these guys get out in outside of the subway? It's interesting. It feels very Dog Day Afternoon, you know, where it's, you know, you've got the robbers that are stuck in the bank and Dog Day Afternoon, and you keep wondering, are they ever going to get out of this bank? You know, and what's going to happen when they get out of the bank is, you know, they're contained inside of there. And once they get out, you know, they're kind of, it's almost a guarantee that you're going to lose them on the streets of New York, you know. And that's the great thing about a New York setting in those days, is that you can just disappear in the crowd.
Yeah. And, you know, another thing that's really fascinating about it, too, is it's almost anticlimactic in the fact that you do lose Robert Shaw 20 minutes before the movie's done, you know. And, you know, and you see it for the first time, you're just like, huh? Like, I mean, why did he, you know, he died. I mean, and he died foolishly and almost stupidly to a certain extent. And I think that's another thing that sets it out, too, is that unconventional, you know, plot twist.
Yeah, and I personally love his death. I think that's great. Rather than go to jail, he's going to off himself. And the way that he does it is just so good. And then Matthau's reaction to it is awesome as well. And, you know, you don't get that kind of stuff from any of these remakes. I'm trying to think of how Vincent D'Onofrio bought it in the first remake. And obviously it was such a stunning death scene that I don't even remember it. So sorry, I'm usually a big Vincent D'Onofrio fan, but even that one, it was just like, he just did not strike me at all. And the whole thing about his character's background, the Mr. Whatever his name is, Ryder, his background as being a soldier of fortune and you know, kind of working his way around these different armies. And that's one nice thing about the book that the movies don't necessarily have, is a little bit more of that. But really with Robert Shaw in the Sergeant version, you do get hints of his background and you do build his character. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff left up to the imagination, but you can really fill it in well.
And you know, yeah, you just get enough to get, you know, with Shaw's character, you get just enough of it to be intrigued by it. And you have this feeling that this guy was probably a real badass at one point, you know, and he's just wants to do that last job, you know, so he can magically happily ever after end up on a beach in Tahiti somewhere drinking margaritas, you know, maybe with a hot chick on his arm or something.
Yeah. And sometimes I almost wonder though, if he knows that he's doomed. I mean, it is such a weird robbery to take on. And he does, you know, they have it very well planned and everything, but it does seem like maybe he's just kind of throwing his chips in for the last time and just saying, okay, either I am very successful and I do end up in Tahiti or whatever. But I think with this character, even if the robbery was successful, 6 months down the line, he's going to do something else because he is this kind of adventurer character. And I just want to talk a little bit. In the book, he's not British. And in any of the remakes, he's not British. But for me, it really adds just another fascinating facet to his character that he's, you know, well, obviously Robert Shaw was not American, but, you know, he could have dropped the accent. He could have done whatever. But it made sense for me that he was British and that, you know, I could see him like going down to, you know, South Africa and being down there and, you know, basically fighting against the blacks or whatever. You know, it seems like wherever the money was, he was going to be there and he wanted just the adventure more than anything. And this seemed like his last gasp at adventure. And just to add on that for real quick, making John Travolta into a badass, first off, that's a really bad idea in any context. Putting him in the shoes of Robert Shaw in this remake was just such folly. And the other thing that's even worse, first off, he's not a badass. Second off, the character is supposed to be some sort of like money manager kind of guy, like almost like a white collar criminal. And so why he's, you know, such a hard ass now, you know, yeah, he went to jail and stuff, but yeah, it's like, it just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And it boggled my mind the whole time while I was watching the remake. It's just how bad it was.
That, you know, that whole conversion has something and everything to do with anal rape in prison. It'll make you a tough man.
Is that what does it?
That is.
All right. Well, I guess John Travolta might be right there. I love how, like, within the last 6 months, it seems to be, like, just kind of a given that John Travolta is gay. And I don't get that. You know, it's like, where was that when he was, you know, like, disco dancing and everything? You know, he was still macho then, but it's only been within, like, you know, from Ricky Gervais making that gay joke on the Golden Globes, like, after that it seems like everybody's saying, oh yeah, John Travolta's got to be gay, Kelly Preston's just a complete beard.
He's not gay, he's just cuddly, and you know, he's very maybe.
The other thing that I find to be a real shame with the remake of Pelham 123, and I'm sorry to just keep dogging this, but when the original is so good and there's no bloody reason to remake it, but you know, the only thing the remake of Pelham had going for me was Louis Guzman. I love Louis Guzman, and to see him in there, and I was like, oh, cool, you know, he's going to be like he's the Joe Welcome character, basically. And I was like, yeah, this is going to be great, you know. And instead, he ends up being the other guy, you know, because there's the four robbers, right? You've got Martin Balsam, Hector Elizondo, Robert Shaw, and the other guy.
He's not important.
He's not important, unfortunately. And that's kind of what Louis Guzman ended up being. And actually, in the remake, there are like three the other guys. There's John Travolta, and then there's the other guys. And so Louis Guzman is completely shifted to the back. And it was so sad for me to see such a great actor just completely wasted in that movie.
Well, the whole movie is a waste. Once again, fuck you, Tony Scott.
So, you've heard from us. Now it's time to tell us what you thought about the film and its two remakes. So please go to www.projection-booth.com and leave us a comment. We'll be right back with more from inside the projection booth.
Ahoy, mateys. This is K.A.B., Antonio Bay. Stevie Wayne here, beaming a signal across the sea. I'll be here playing music all through the witching hour. I'm still waiting to hear from that weatherman. But in the meantime, stay here with me. Be sure to visit our sponsor, Paracinema Magazine. They're the source for all your genre movie needs. Check them out online at paracinema.net. Tell them Stevie sent you. Keep me turned on for a while, and I'll do my best to do the same for you.
The smooth sound. Fabulous 1340.
Yeah, hi, this is Dolph Lundgren, and you're in the projection booth with Mike and Justin.
20th Century Fox presents Phantom of the Paradise.
Life at last!
The story of the Phantom who haunts the paradise, the ultimate rock palace.
This place is possessed.
He sold his soul for rock and roll. Phantom of the Paradise, rated PG, parental guidance suggested.
Welcome back, everyone. That was a great hard-to-find radio promo recorded by one of my life's heroes, Wolfman Jack, for the 1974 Brian De Palma-directed Phantom of the Paradise, and which we'll be covering a few weeks down the road. Oh, yeah, you know, before we play back our interview with Chris Gore, Mike, real fast, I want to ask you something. So, you know, I wanted to ask you if you could share your, you know, your personal experience in terms of how you actually met Chris Gore, you know, that whole ultimate film fanatic experience you mentioned in your book.
Oh, geez. Well, actually, it's kind of funny because Chris talks about the ultimate film fanatic in my book, Impossibly Funky, a Chaos Jews to Cinema Art collection, available now for purchase. But I don't really talk about that in there. I did write a story of my whole experience, and I think that was in Cashiers to Cinemark number 14, where I tell the whole story. And I almost think that maybe I should have included that in the book, because it would have been, for lack of a better term, nice bookends to the whole thing, to have Chris at the beginning talking about it and then have my experience at the end. But it's funny because talking to Chris on the phone just a few weeks ago when we interviewed him was the first time I had sat down and talked with him since 1994, 93, 94. So before that, and before 94 and after 94, up until maybe 2001 or so, it was just pretty much complete animosity between the two of us. Chris was, like I said before, he founded Film Threat magazine here in Detroit, which was kind of a big deal, local boy made good kind of thing. But it was one of those, like, I don't know, like a kill your idol kind of thing, where it's like, hey, you're doing this really cool thing, but I can do it better. And I won't say that I did do a better magazine than Film Threat. I would never even put that forward. But it was one of those, like, if I were to do this, here's what I would do, and just tried to do my own thing a little bit more. So yeah, it was really nice to finally sit down and chat with Chris and just kind of, you know, put the past behind us.
Gotcha. All right. So without further delay, here's the interview we did with Chris Gore. You'll notice that we had a hard time getting in some questions. Enjoy.
So how did Film Threat come about?
I was in high school and there was an underground fanzine there called The Truth that I had contributed to. The Truth was basically a parody zine making fun of stuff that was happening around the high school. And I had just contributed a few articles to that zine. I was kind of inspired by it, and I was inspired by all the punk rock zines that were coming out at the time. But my passion was movies. It was really just discovering movies and saying, well, I'm going to start an underground movie magazine. That's what I'm going to do. Sort of worked on the layout for the zine. It wasn't until I went to college and I met this guy named Andre Seawood at Wayne State University, who was a very serious thinker, very academic, and I just wanted to do things that were funny, and I enjoyed fucking with people. This is 6 months of sort of getting ready to do one, and after having met Andre, it's like, all right, you contribute articles, I'll write some articles, I'll be stupid. But it was really the movie Dune that like got me off my ass to do the first issue, because I so loved those books when I was a kid, and I was so excited. It was the first time I really feel like movie hype betrayed me. Back then, I mean, there's all this movie hype, and there's a double issue of Cine Fantastique magazine. And when that came out, I was so offended at how horrendous that film was. I blamed Dino De Laurentiis, not David Lynch. That was the movie that inspired, I'm going to put out this first issue. And then I didn't have a lot of money at the time, like a lot of punk rock kids going to college. I just wrote a check that I knew would bounce. Now you can't get away with that stuff. $50 to Kinko's, downtown Detroit, had 500 copies of the first issue and distributed them to our film class like in February of 84 or 85. But that was sort of the origin. It wasn't like I was bit by a radioactive Roger Ebert. Film threat went through many incarnations. It just died and kept being resurrected like a villain from a James Cameron movie. You know, film threat would die and then it would come back as, well, it's a newsprint now. And then it would die and then, well, we sold it to Larry Flint. And then it would die and then it's now an email newsletter and it would die. And now it's a website. And it was just like, it just kept going through all these weird incarnations. I like to say that basically the story of Film Threat is exactly like Facebook, except with far fewer lawsuits and nobody gets rich.
So, Chris, I was just curious to see if you remember an article that Film Threat put out back in like 91, 92, where you had Josh Becker visit the set of Reservoir Dogs.
I do remember that. I just remember meeting Quentin Tarantino and coming to my house and saying, hey, I'm getting ready to start this movie. And I said, oh, cool, up-and-coming filmmaker, we'll be sure to cover your movie. And Josh Becker was the guy that, like, I don't want to do the where you go to the set. You have sort of a, you know, an indirect connection to Quentin. Just do a sort of preview coverage of this film. Sounds cool.
Right. And in that article, you know, Josh Becker called Quentin Tarantino ugly. So I was just wondering if Tarantino ever contacted you, you know, in response, like, was he pissed off?
I mean, we do like to report the truth. Quentin's a weird-looking dude. I didn't hear any flack from that. I did hear some flack about the story that was later when Pulp Fiction came out and, Mike, your video that inspired all of that. There was no internet for that thing to spread virally, but it did spread virally on VHS, that's for sure.
I think I have you to thank for that. I seem to remember reading an article where you sent my short to some reporter and marked the VHS tape evidence across it.
Right. Well, I wanted it just to get out there. I didn't want to be the only outlet covering this. I was really offended. I mean, I think about it now, though, and I think like so many filmmakers steal stuff. It really goes unnoticed. For example, I think George Lucas, even in his early career, stole so many things, but it was such a mix of so many different influences and blending and a whole fresh original tone that it doesn't feel like stealing at all. It's just, I mean, there are plenty of people that steal badly. I mean, a lot of bad genre horror movies steal stuff poorly. But people that really do it well, Quentin Tarantino, George Lucas, just do it in a way that just feels so fresh and original that the original source is just sort of just adding on or just sort of using that as inspiration and then taking it another step.
You go to a lot of film festivals, and you've written how many of those Ultimate Film Festival Survival Guides?
Up to the fourth edition of the book right now.
So are you still going out every year to festivals?
I do. I try to go to a film festival I've never been to because I just want to sort of add another little notch to like the number of film festivals I've attended. But this is the first year I'm actually taking a break from festivals. I'm just attempting to do some other projects. And in order to do that, I'm taking a break this year from film festivals.
So speaking of film festivals, I've heard you've gotten some flack over the years from some of the film festivals you've written about. Maybe you care to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, what one was it? It was something like the New York International Independent Film Festival, blah, blah, blah. I mean, basically, I say in my book, like, if you're spending more than $100 on an entry fee, or if someone is actually cold calling you or sending you this cold email out of the blue saying, you know, hey, we saw your movie, and it's a really good chance that if you submit your movie to our festival, you'll get in the festival, but you have to send us $100. That's just someone who wants $100.
Yeah, and aren't those festival promoters really great at policing everything that's said about them?
They threatened me. I mean, they somehow got my home number, called me up at home and threatened to sue me because they make, first of all, they've got the money to sue, but I have no problem telling people about these scam film festivals. But a lot of times, you know, their justification is like, well, you can give all this money to these other festivals, you don't get in. At least if you give us money, you're guaranteed to get in. They got you on the hook and they say, now that you're in the festival, why don't you pay us to advertise your trailer and pay us to put up your movie posters and pay us to screen. So they offer this sort of menu of entree items of other services that they sell you where you can go to one of these scam festivals and drop $5,000 pretty quickly. So this is where they get all their money. And to me, I look at it as no different than if filmmakers weren't giving them money, they wouldn't be successful. But the reason filmmakers are giving these festivals money is because they've been rejected even from the shitty film festival. What the people are seeking when they're paying, they're seeking some vindication that the time they spent, the years, the heartache, the dollars, the investment that they put in, they don't want to be embarrassed to their family and their friends and to the people they made the film with. So they get to say, hey, I was at the blah, blah, blah International Independent Film Festival where we won an award, which they paid for. Yeah, I'm not a fan of those types of festivals. But you got to learn the lesson. If your movie was rejected from a bunch of film festivals, maybe you should make a better movie.
You were a part of that official rejection documentary, weren't you?
I'm in it. I pop up now and then. I'm also on the commentary. I forgot.
How many documentaries have you been in to date?
Recently, I'm going to cut back. I'm in Sticky, which is a movie about masturbation. It's funny because they have like Jocelyn Elders is on there. She was the Surgeon General of the United States under Clinton, who actually was recommending that kids masturbate. Then there's Priests. I am the entertainment expert. So I talk about famous scenes and how masturbation is portrayed in the media, specifically film. So it's always portrayed as an act that is grotesque. And I've always thought of it as something I really enjoy doing on a fairly regular basis.
And then you're also in the People versus George Lucas documentary with me.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Oh, I forgot about that documentary. Yeah, no, I love that doc. I think to me that's the best of the docs that I've seen. There's a couple of others that are in post-production, but People versus George Lucas I really like because I don't think it's a complete, it doesn't completely slam George.
So what have you been up to lately? You're doing G4's Attack of the Show. You're taking a break from film festivals. What else do you have in the works?
Yeah, I mean, I sold filmthreat.com to Mark Bell, who's doing a great job running that. And it was sort of like a way for me to be able to take a step back and get out from under that obligation, which was a huge, I don't want to do that stuff anymore, so I want to take a step back. So I've been working on a book, which was originally supposed to be a book about Film Threat, which is now kind of morphed into something else. The working title of it right now is just Nerdlebrity, because it's not just about Film Threat. Film Threat's part of it, but it's all these other bizarre nerd stories kind of getting me to where I am now. So I'm working on that. I am working on a documentary about Film Threat, but I don't know exactly what my role will be. Right now, I'm just archiving every piece of footage, every photograph, creating a digital library of this stuff in anticipation of doing a documentary at some point. I, of course, do an Attack of the Show. I just did a show for Travel Channel. I'm working on another film, which I don't want to talk about now, but another film that I hope to submit to festivals before the end of the year. And then I'm also focusing on my stand-up comedy.
How'd you become interested in doing stand-up comedy?
Ever since I was a kid, I've loved comedy, you know, whether it be Saturday Night Live, which I recorded with a cassette recorder when I was a kid so I could just listen to Saturday Night Live on cassette tape, to, you know, listening to comedy albums, to just being obsessed with it, to going to see stand-up comedy, to just seeing some of my favorite alt comedians cross over into movies like Zach Galifianakis, or following the careers of people like Patton Oswalt and Paul F. Tompkins, and then being around that world. And then, you know, I wrote a comedy, my big fat independent movie, and it's like destiny punching me in the face, where I would be at the hardware store just talking to someone at the register and they would ask me, are you a comedian? I was in an airport. Are you a comedian? Talking to nobody. Are you a comedian? This happens to me constantly. And I go, yes, fine. I am. Literally the universe just saying, why aren't you a comedian? And I'm not going to say, other than just doing some stand-up gigs, because I don't think stand-up is necessarily a career anymore. It's difficult, unless you're someone at a certain level, like a Doug Benson, who has like this tour, or a Paul F. Tompkins, or like a Dane Cook. If you're one of the sort of big guys who can fill big places, you can make money doing that. Stand-up really is, for someone like Patton Oswalt, that got him writing gigs. You know, he would do punch-up on things. So for me, stand-up is a way that will just help me do other parts of my career. And also it's a good thing. It's it's also one of those purging things when you get up on stage and talk about your life. And that's something that I would do randomly. I'd be at panel discussions at film festivals and talk about anal sex. It would just sort of come out. I would tell some bizarre effed up story about anal. I don't know why it would come out. It just would. And it just really not quite exactly the right forum, but you know, it made me, in some cases, it would get me invited back because people thought I was so funny and unpredictable. And in other cases, I would never be invited to do any panel speaking at all, like at Sundance. I just feel like it's something that I've always sort of had this leaning towards. I go for the funny, even when I do the film reviews. I don't think that I'm particularly great at doing film reviews, but I can distill a complex idea into kind of a joke where you get exactly what I'm trying to say. I'm able to convey my ideas through humor in some simplified form. And I just do that every week from Attack of the Show. I've been doing it 6 years now. So I feel like now I want to do stand-up and then have that meld into something else. I mean, if it melded into some sort of tour or going somewhere and whatnot, I think that would be great. But I don't know that I have enough material yet for that to even be remotely possible. Maybe I could open for someone and do 7 minutes. But anything beyond that, I'm not ready for. So I'm using that to do other stuff. I've had offers to do some podcasts, but I actually prefer to be a guest in a podcast rather than actually do a podcast. It's a lot of work to do a podcast. You have to arrange stuff. You have to talk to people. Then you got to do all the technical stuff. And for me, I'm just like, you mean I show up, I'm funny, bye. Turnkey stuff I can do. Books, I can write a book. Sit down, I need paper or a computer, I'm fine. But anything other than that, that involves like infrastructure and all these, I would always set up stuff with Film Threat where it would just sort of run itself. And then I wouldn't have to do that much work after that. And for podcasts, it's still not as easy as Click Podcast.
So can you tell me a little bit about how my Big Fat Independent Movie happened?
Oh, great. I don't know what my Rotten Tomatoes score is, but I'm pretty sure it's below average. I don't know. That was just, I really wanted to like break away from being the film critic. That term has always bugged me. Like, frankly, I don't consider you necessarily a film critic. You are capable of doing film criticism, but you're not a film critic per se because you have many other ideas and you can do investigative journalism and you can edit and create content like you are with a podcast and videos. So you're not a film critic, but the term film critic is almost like saying, you've got AIDS. I shouldn't have sex with you. It's a derisive term, film critic. You know, it's not looked on as positive. And it really always has bugged me that because, you know, there are all types of critics, right? There's people who write in, Consumer Reports, and they write reviews of cars and vehicles. And that gives you really good information. What kind of car should I get? Or reviews of types of prescription drugs or reviews of product, you know, video games. Is this worth it? When it comes to the film critic, there is a disdain for anyone with that labeled as that because it's like if you like a film that this critic does not or the critic points out some flaws, it's as if you've attacked their baby and called it ugly. So I've never been comfortable with that term, never thought of myself as a film critic, and fucking hated when anyone ever called me that. It just bugged me. And I thought, you know what, fuck it, I'm going to do this, you know, but I don't want to direct this first film. I want to learn about, you know, the finance stuff and how that works. I want to write, but I just want to be in a job where I'll be able to learn all that I possibly can without the risk necessarily of putting my name out there as director. So I hired this guy. I'd written a script with these two guys. They were writers from the MTV Movie Awards. We got together and wrote this script, My Big Fat Independent Movie. And I had sort of this outline and like it was going to be a road movie and this. I said, here's the movies we're going to spoof. And we wrote the script together. I was actually working on the title sequence before I had the title of the movie, I had the website and all this stuff before I even had the money for the movie. Hooked up with a guy who was going to say we could do it for like 75 grand. We could give you 75 grand to make it, which ultimately turned out not to be true. His wife actually ran up with a male stripper, and in the midst of his divorce, he said, I really can't afford to do this film. So here I am, like 2 weeks before shooting in July, and I'd attached Padgett Brewster, and I was going to get a cameo from Bob Odenkirk. Basically, anyone I'd met on the festival circuit or at Comic-Con, I was going to give them a bit part in the movie, Rob Shrub, you know, people in the comedy scene. And 2 weeks away from shooting, we had to shut down production. Ended up having another meeting with these guys who do foreign translation of EPKs, and they were just looking for a write-off. And so we increased the budget to around $300,000 to shoot it so we could pay all the actors. So we went SAG Limited Exhibition, shot it, and when the movie came out, I actually was very well organized. I'm good at bullshitting like I have my shit together. That's a talent. But if I have one talent, it's like being able to look like I know what I'm talking about. And then it comes in handy when you're on TV, for sure. Although when it comes to movie stuff, I actually got to be honest, I kind of know what I'm talking about. when the movie came out, I was singled out as like the reason. I mean, look, I'm not going to sit there and pretend that the movie's great. I give myself like a C. It's not the worst thing in the world. It has its highlights. It's definitely not great. Not the worst thing. There's some things that are really clever. It's really ambitious for what it was trying to do. In fact, I just watched it like last week, and I haven't watched it in years. And it's like you can't. It's hard to even get used copies of it now. It's kind of like run out of its supply. And it's not as bad as I remembered it. But it got crucified, and they all blamed me personally. And I think that there might have been a little bit of professional jealousy on the part of film critics out there, because you know I'm a freaking loudmouth when it comes to saying something is good or something sucks. I tell people now my goal in life is to make a good movie. You know, that really is actually still my goal, is to make a good movie. I mean, I'm lucky enough in my position, you know, at G4 and the way I scrape by a living in the entertainment business, I'm able to kind of just work on some things on the side. But I'm really particular. I don't want to make the same mistakes I did with my Big Fat Independent movie. So the next movie I make, I want it to be better. And I want to be in a position to make a better film with a better script and, you know, transition to being, frankly, being not so much in front of the camera. Although I'm reluctantly in front of the camera, it's never something I aspired to do. Seriously. Never wanted to be on TV. I just ended up on TV.
The one bit I really did like in the movie was the Pauly Shore bit. That was funny.
To become a real badass anti-hero, you gotta go after someone who is the embodiment of pure evil. Someone despised by all mankind. So universally hated that just seeing the painful death will bring forth a burst of joy.
Yo, what's up, bro? What's up? What's the... No.
Not bad. Yeah. Not bad.
You know, I wrote that. When I look back, I'm really proud of the fact that the things that get the biggest laughs are the things I wrote, which are all the inside movie knowledge, like with the El Mariachi guy and the Amelie Chip meeting, but they can't talk to each other because they're speaking different languages. Then they try to read subtitles in their English. You know, stupid things like that that are more like film school jokes. But the reason I wanted to make my Big Fat Independent movie is I was sick of fucking independent films. I thought independent films had become cliche, and whenever a genre is dead, they make a spoof movie. You know, I mean, when the Western was dead, Mel Brooks made Blazing Saddle. So I thought, well, indie film is dead. Every movie is like a lesbian that was molested by her father that goes on the road to seek some spiritual journey where she's going to bond with the people that she shouldn't. And you could literally play Mad Libs of indie film and it's the same fucking movie. And I was sick of going to film festivals and seeing the same movies praised, and anything that was sort of like out of that arena, i.e. comedy or genre, you know, sci-fi, fantasy, horror, was not as embraced. Now I think those other genres are more embraced. But at the time I really started making my Big Fat Independent movie, which is around 2002, 2003, I started working on the script. And we shot in 2003. See, I only make a movie every 10 years. The number of scripts I have now, I'm hoping that I can back to back do a couple projects and get over whatever the fear is. But I know exactly what the fear is. It's not having a paycheck. It's seeing friends that are, you know, around my age that'll go and take a risk. And it's like, so you quit your job to go and make that indie film. How'd that all work out? And they had some cush job as like an editor at NBC or something where they're making a ton of money and they're begging to get back in. So, I mean, that's what's the thing that stopped me more than anything is I need to make money to pay for stuff. Although with this fucked up new world economy and just everything going into shambles as we spiral closer and closer to World War III, this is the time I think that like is the time to kind of take a risk, you know, to take time off and do the novel you always wanted to do. Just because I have so many friends that are unemployed and friends that like, you know, been looking for a job for a year that have moved back. And these are people who've lived in LA, not just people who just moved here. Talk about people who've lived in LA for 15 fucking years. And the industry has kind of moved out of LA. I mean, it's too expensive to hire people here. I mean, to be honest, it's too expensive to live here. I fucking hate living here. I would not wish dating in Los Angeles on Hitler. That's how awful it is here.
Right, right. It sounds just like that scene in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
What is
Harry?
It out here? With these women?
Oh, please, Harry, they're no different from anywhere else.
Yes, they are. These are damaged goods. Every one of them from way back. I'm telling you, you take a guy who sleeps with 100 women a year, going to his childhood, dollars to donuts, it's relatively unspectacular. Now, you take one of these, gals sleeps with 100 guys a year, and I bet you if you look in their childhood, there's something rotten in Denver.
Denmark.
That too, but it's abandonment, it's abuse, it's my uncle put his ping-ping in my papa, and then they all come out here. I mean, it's literally like someone took America by the East Coast and shook it, and all the normal girls managed to hang on.
Okay, everybody who hates Harry here, raise their hand.
See that? Obedient little bitches, too.
Fuck you!
Yeah, exactly. They all moved to L.A. I mean, it's just absolutely the fucking worst. But I am seeing a girl right now that is she's relatively sane. Now, my biggest complaint about her is that I have no complaints about her. But I resist using the word girlfriend when it comes to her because I hate that word. There's got to be a word between girl I put my penis in and girlfriend. There's something in the middle of that that doesn't imply, you know what I mean? Obligation. I resist it.
Sounds like you've got enough obligations going on as it is.
Yeah, I've got too many obligations. I've definitely put a lot more effort into career-oriented stuff, the stand-up being a part of that.
So, Chris, when do you think you're going to get the chance to interview Charlie Sheen?
I would love to. I think what's weird is he sounded so crazy and all that other stuff. You know, some of the other interviews. And then he was on Stern the other day and he sounded coherent. The guy, I don't know, I kind of admire the guy. Like, I really feel that the reason he's being crucified in the media is because we're fucking pussies. You know, men have become pussy. You know, he's really living the life that, you know, if guys had balls these days, yeah, we'd fuck whores and drink and do drugs all the time. But we got to look sensitive. Definitely become like the pussification of America. And I think that Charlie Sheen looks crazy because he's not that. And, you know, that kind of admire him for living the life and being like, fuck it, this is what I do. I never saw a morality clause when I do this show. Does the show, he does the job, and I think he's got a feel, and he's definitely stood up for the people who are not getting paid on that show. I would love to interview him, although I have had a brush with Charlie Sheen. And what's odd is that he's had all these bad influences on his life, right? Like he's had drug dealers that have influenced him, porn stars. I actually helped Charlie Sheen be recognized as a good citizen. I don't know if you know this story. Back in the day, back in the 90s, you know, when VHS was king. It never came out that I was the guy, but I had become friends with a film director named Adam Rifkin. And at the time, Charlie Sheen was in his movie, The Chase. So I'd met Charlie Sheen, super nice guy, whatever. I became sort of his dealer for weird videos, whether it was hentai porn from Japan, Legend of the Overfiend and whatnot. I was really Charlie Sheen's dealer for weird video. And I had lent him a film that was called Guinea Pig. Now, as you're well aware, Guinea Pig is a fake snuff film. It's a snuff film. A guy basically disembowels and almost does a live autopsy on a woman who dies. Now, to me, looking at it, it's like, yes, this is really cheesy effects. It's very Grand Guignol type of stuff. Not my thing. I'm not a big fan of the gore. He wanted the most extreme, hardcore stuff, and there was nothing more extreme or hardcore than this film, Guinea Pig. I lent Charlie Sheen the VHS tape of Guinea Pig, and it freaked him the fuck out. He was fucking freaked out from this video. He proceeds from this tape to contact me to say, look, what's up with this? I said, it's fake. It's fake. He told his friend who's in the FBI about this film because he said, look, a woman dies in this movie. I said, no, it's fake. Says, no, you've got to be interrogated by the FBI, which is now my second encounter with the FBI, actually. The first came about when I interviewed John Hinckley from prison. And I had written John Hinckley in prison and asked him very innocently, I'm a teenager at the time, would you mind reviewing Taxi Driver for my underground fanzine film threat? He wrote a letter back and said, I can't really say much, but, and then proceeded to give me his thoughts on Taxi Driver, which I published in then the underground version of Film Threat magazine, which got all sorts of national attention, which happened to get me on an FBI watch list. Because if you do correspond with someone who's tried to assassinate the president of the United States and become friends with them, you'll be on a watch list. I spoke with Charlie Sheen's buddy, who was in the FBI, about this film and pleaded with him, this is fake. I'm sorry. If you look at this, you know, the blood is fake. No, he said he was having people like these sort of video forensic guys look at this video to examine it, but he wanted to know the source and was not going to let me away unless I gave the source. I mean, he was not going to let me go, like not going to let me. You've got to reveal the source, which is a guy named Chaz Ballin. And he's going to tell you exactly the same thing he told told me it's fake. Well, unbeknownst to me, this guy Chaz is like a big dealer of marijuana, and any contact with the authorities coming via me sounds like I ratted him out. I ratted him out because it's like, hey, he's the guy I got a videotape from. Later, he turned out to be a real scumbag because he was actually bootlegging videos that I was legally selling in the United States because I had gotten deals with filmmakers who I paid residuals to, but he was bootlegging our videos and selling them. We got in a fight at some horror convention. The guy's a big biker guy. He's like 6'5", 100 pounds on me, easy, at the time. And he proceeds to, one of his toadies came up and tried to start some kind of conflict between the two of us. And he tried to pour a beer on me, but was great as I deflected it with my arm, which the beer landed all over his toady, which was great. But I just stood my ground and said, look, dude, you're selling movies that I have the rights to. I think it was quarterly basis, would write checks to filmmakers like Richard Kern and Jörg Butgerett in Germany and Todd Phillips, you know, now a big filmmaker in Hollywood. I was distributing his movies legally in the United States. And this guy was bootlegging them. Fucker, you're taking money out of my pocket, pirating those movies. Long and the short of it was, a big story came out on Hard Copy about this Charlie Sheen thing, that he was being recognized by the FBI as a good citizen for having turned in the snuff film, which was my video. I never got it back. But it was all in the media in the early 90s that he was recognized. It was on Hard Copy. It was on all these shows. My name was never mentioned, and I never got the tape back. I like to think I set him on his dark path. So fuck you, Charlie.
So to leave us, can you tell us your best stand-up joke?
Oh, my best joke. Oh, man, I don't know. The thing is this, I don't know so much tell jokes so much as I just relate real things that happen in my life. I mean, in terms of like the way I deal with women, the reason that I do well enough with women is not because I'm actually good at dealing with women. Frankly, I think I'm terrible. It's that I just don't do what everybody else does. Everybody tends to do the same stupid stuff. Let's go to dinner and a movie, because that hasn't happened a million times. But I just do stuff like, I'll keep a card in my pocket, like literally like a Hallmark card. And I will save this card in my pocket for weeks. I'm seeing a girl, because girls like things that are thoughtful. And what's more thoughtful than giving a really nice Hallmark card? At an appointed time that is exactly right, I will give her this card. She's going to open the card, and inside the card it says, thanks for the blowjob. The other card that I like to give girls is, I like spending time with you when my penis is not inside you. If you think about it, it's kind of romantic. It's sweet. There's something sweet about that. So I don't know if like, I mean, I guess I have stuff that you could say as jokes, but it just sort of organically comes from just telling stories, just weird fucked up shit that's happened to me. I don't think it's a traditional sort of boom punchline. Funny. I mean, there's some of that in there, but it's woven into larger stories. I'm still developing all this stuff and trying to figure out what it is. And that's, I know from the people who do really well at it, I think I can write humor. I think I can be a little funny in my segment, but the stand-up thing is this, I like that I've never done it. That's what's really fun. I've never done it, like, I mean, not been successful at it. Now, wait, you got to have me on this podcast again, because there's a lot more. First of all, I think I talk too much, but I do that sort of naturally. But I really want to be able to talk more about some other stuff. I actually do have to get going, but there's a lot more ground for us to cover. So have me back.
That brings us to the end of this week's show. Next week, we'll be providing possibly a very much longer episode, as Justin and I attempt to give you the most in-depth discussion and commentary ever podcasted, including clips, mind you, for one of our favorite films, David Lynch's Dune. So remember that fear is the mind killer.
Okay, so, you know, I know you've made some comments that, you know, you're upset that you had to go down and get popcorn alone. So
it sounds like I'm a pig, that I'm constantly going down and getting popcorn.
It's really good. All right. So, you know, I'll make you a deal. Let's both go down and get some popcorn. And, you know, as we head down to our seats, you know, at your request, I guess, and being that we're in Detroit, we'll leave you with Ted Nugent doing
a little Motor City Madhouse. Enjoy.